thank you for taking the time to download and listen to this podcast from Celtic Underground. You are possibly picking this up on thecelticunderground.substack.com. If you are a paid subscriber, you can link your account to wherever you pick up your podcasts, whether that be Spotify, Apple, Amazon, wherever, and you can pick up the subscription feed where you get your normal feed. Just go on to Substack on the website and follow the instructions. Meantime, this is Andrew H. Smith in conversation.
Hi all, I'd like to start this episode with an acknowledgement or an admission. Really, long before now should we have delved into the nuts and bolts of the Celtic Collective. So I am privileged and honoured and grateful to Paul Thompson for allowing us to rectify that today. So Paul Thompson from the Celtic Collective, and many of you might know him from RGC. Great to have you on, Paul, and thanks for making the time for us.
Thanks, Andrew. I'm not sure if I'm the nut or the bolt of the collective, but we'll see
there's
how it goes.
There's quite a few nuts, earth. No, I'm joking. I'm joking.
We'll take it.
Okay. But I suppose we're bolted onto it, and people think we're the kind of anti-collective collective members, but I suppose that's one of the things that... Is it such a loose coalition? Do people maybe not understand? What is the Celtic Collective? Because, I mean, this is... Let's be Celtic Collective 101 here in terms of, what is it?
So, good question. It came together, sort of coalesced on the back of the open letter that a number of the supporter groups put together in September. Now, that was on the back of, in itself, a number of meetings that the, let's call them traditional supporters groups had with the club in the previous week or two. So, by traditional, I mean CSA, trust, affiliation, the Irish Supporters Association, that kind of thing. Green Brigade, the boys, obviously, as well. That sparked off what then became a widely supported open letter. I think initially it was about maybe 15, 20, maybe slightly upwards of that, organisations and supporters clubs involved in that. And that sort of mushroomed over a week or two into, I guess, what became the collective. It's really trying to represent as broad a coalition of the Celtic support as possible, Andrew. Now, there's no such thing as a single view of Celtic. You know, we've all supported the club long enough to know that the opinions and the way expressing those opinions can vary quite dramatically, and the emotions involved in that are significant as well. So I guess what we've tried to do is get representation pretty much across the board from the main supporters associations, the ultras, as many of the supporters' buses who often get their voices unheard because they're not part of the CSA or the affiliation or the Irish groups. And then, most importantly, I guess, the wider support, the independent Celtic supporters who quite often, you know, find themselves without a voice at all because, the conversations are taking place at a level with a club that, you know, independent supporters don't really get much of a look in. So it is pretty broad. You know, I'm not for a minute suggesting that we represent everybody, but the opportunity is there to represent everybody, if I can put it that way, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, who was the Brother Walford? I mean, it has to start somewhere. There has to be a genesis somewhere, because I suppose one of the, and I think Celtic Collective's an impossible position, whether or not I agree with a lot of what they do, or whether or not I feel detached from it, I would always, always, always recognise it's almost impossible what you are trying to do. Like, but where did it start? Because the whole kind of, you know, the murmurings that it's just a souped up Green Brigade. I've said that myself at times, like, for better or worse. You know, when it comes into life, like, you know, we even see some of the same iconography and all that, and maybe all that stuff existed there, so it's easy to use in terms of typefaces and fonts and did it, and even just stylistically it looked, you know. But so it must have came from someone, you know. It must have.
And if you take yourself back to the first meeting of what became the collective was in central Glasgow, Gracie's, I think mid-September, towards, I can't remember the date exactly, Andrew, but
that was after the letter, wasn't it?
Well, the letter was probably initiated with a I guess the North Curve guys initiated it, but strongly supported by the groups who'd been in that previous week to see the club. So that would have been the CSA and the affiliation and the Irish supporters clubs. The Irish guys in particular were very vocal in the back of that meeting. And I think the CSA had, just before that open letter had went out, had put an fairly unprecedented for them statement out, you know, saying how disappointed they'd been with the engagement they'd had with the club. And that was really the catalyst for it, I think. It very quickly grew to a point where there had to be a decision about whether it became a thing or not, and that's where we got to the point where we ended up with a group of people in a room in Glasgow trying to thrash out what a coalition might look like, for want of a better description. It certainly wasn't called the collective.
Yeah, I mean, so then we come to, you have to create a steering group. I mean, I know yous are all volunteers, and I know that when our criticism's levelled, it's like, these are guys that are doing it. And I use guys, I don't use it in the majority, I don't mean it in terms of males. These are people that are just doing it in their spare time, and da-da-da. But I mean, I was many years on a community council, local community council here, North Kelvin side. We were all volunteers, but we still worked to Articles Association, constitution, voting structures, all these things. I mean, is it more embryonic than that? Is it, where are we in those kind of?
I think that is that's where we would like things to go. If I'm being honest, Andrew, it's just been a really, really busy couple of months. You know, we started with a series of issues that people were concerned about that came out of that original letter, the seven questions for the board. And then we got into a whole series of events that have been quite time consuming. You know, there's been protests at games, there's been marches, demonstrations, but I guess in terms of newsworthy items, there was the issues around the AGM, there was issues around the Green Brigade, issues around banning the fan media, and that, if I'm being honest, probably taking quite a lot of energy. The ideal scenario still is that, you know, the steering group is a coalition of representatives of different groups and different individuals who volunteered themselves based on their day jobs, if you like, in terms of their skills and their abilities, myself included. That's where I came into it. And we would like to get to a point where if it is a long term thing, that there's a structure that sits below that that's, I guess, democratic. We've tried to say we want to be a democratic organisation. We've tried to follow democratic principle, but you're absolutely right. That has to start with people being in roles in a democratic manner. You know, we had to start it some way, and we will get to a point where we need to get that infrastructure in place very soon.
When did you come in? Are you on the steering group?
I'm on the steering group.
Yeah, that's another thing that maybe Do we know everybody that's on the steering group? Or is there this kind of...
We've been pretty public about it.
Is it published anywhere? Or?
I'll come back to it. If you start with me, I came in here at the original meeting, so the first meeting, funnily enough, sitting with Harry Brady of your parish. Him and I were, you know, there together to hear what this was all about and see what it was about. And I'll be honest, my initial reason for volunteering, and there was a call at the end of the meeting for anybody that felt that their skills could help. You know, I come into it from more of a corporate background. You know, I'm not coming from it from the kind of maybe the emotive side of things where a number of the other guys come in. My thing is, I come in from a business background, a corporate background. I've looked at the governance of the club, and I've looked at the communications around the club, and those are particular areas of interest for me, because that's my professional life and has been for 30 odd, nearly 40 years now. So I kind of looked at it and said, well, I could maybe help with that. But there was also a bit of looking at how outsiders would have perceived what became the collective at that point. It probably was the normal traditional organisations, plus the Green Brigade, plus the Trust, plus, you know, CSA, etc. So there might have been a view that, oh, this is just the same thing dressed up in another name or dressed up in another thing. So a wee bit of my motivation personally was to to come in it with a slightly different perspective and maybe try and give a different perspective, so there wasn't, you know, both internally to the steering group, but externally to anybody who's looking in. So yeah, so that we ended up, I think, with 20, 21 people who came forward, that when we went through the kind of CVs, if you like, we wanted to make sure there was representation for all the main groups who were involved, but also what other skills were we going to need. So there's some comms people on there, there's people with a business background like myself, really trying to look at that fairly broad seven questions as a start, to how can we start addressing some of the issues within that. We've certainly, you know, we went fairly public on who everybody was. It was published in the one of the meetings, I think the second meeting we had, we made sure everybody in the collective was aware of who was representing them, if you want to call it that. But we have got, you know, that's available, we can stick it on the website or whatever if anybody's got any concerns about that, you know.
Yeah. And who are the members of the collective then? Funnily enough, I mean, we signed that, the Celtic Underground signed that letter. We had a democratic vote and I voted against. I'll be honest, I voted against as being part of it because I just felt it was too Green Brigade. And even if I'm aligned with them entirely kind of politically, like I'm not aligned with them in terms of what I think being a Celtic supporter is, you know. So I didn't want anything to do with it, but I was voted with democratic vote and we voted in favour of joining it, of signing the letter. But then we didn't necessarily think we were in the collective. And then people are saying, why are you not saying more because you're in the collective? But we just signed a letter. You know, we put our name to a letter. We didn't, the 7 points. We didn't necessarily think we were becoming part of the collective.
No, I understand. And, you know, I think what I would say is we have gone back out to everybody to reaffirm that they wanted to stay part. You know, there was a sort of positive opt-in as well. So, I've had this conversation with a couple of the Celtic Underground guys in the past, as you know, that, you know, if you know, you're not in for life if that's a problem. I mean, just going back to your question, in terms of who the steering group members were, well, you know, we've got representation there for the Irish Celtic Supporters Club, the CSA, the Celtic Disabled Supporters Association, the Trust, the North Curve, Green Brigade, Boys. There's 4 fan media reps on there, including myself, coming in from a podcast perspective. And then, I guess importantly, we've got 8 buses represented for across Scotland, England and Ireland. So those are the guys who come in, week out, home and away to represent the club and to support the club, and quite often don't get involved in the discussions around the workings of the clubs. So that's the initial steering group, if you like. There's about 20, 21 names on that. And I say, broadly speaking, it's the old traditional organisations that have, you know, represented supporters for a long time. We've got the Ultras in there, we've got supporters buses and fan media.
And see, if you're an individual and you want to be part of the collective, how do you go about that? I mean, who do you contact and say?
Well, it's easy now. We've got the webpage up, which is CelticFansCollective.com, and there's a subscribe thing on that. Before that, people were dropping us notes and dropping us emails and asking if they could be involved. But yeah, the subscribe thing's made it real. I mean, to give you an example, we had the meeting last Tuesday. Was it last Tuesday? 2 Tuesdays ago, and we've had something like 3,500-4,000 people have subscribed since then, just on the back of that meeting, at the launch of the website. So it's snowballed quite quickly from the website being. I think people were finding it difficult to communicate because we had a go at a website and it wasn't that great, so we sort of started again and set something up a wee bit more user-friendly, and that took a wee bit, you know, because of everything you said at the start about the day jobs, took a couple of weeks longer than it would have liked it to. But now we've got that, people are finding it a lot easier to communicate. So there's means, you know, email and the forms on the website can get information to and us back, you know, and yeah, quite quickly.
Once you subscribe, then will you get kind of mail? Will they get mail shots or whatever? Will they get
basically anything that we're happening, anything that's going on social media or anything that's planned coming up? The subscription allows us just to make sure that the individual supporters are contacted simultaneously. So yeah, it's a mechanism for communicating, Andrew. It's just a means to get that in place. And what we have had through the individuals coming through is we've had a lot of people who've offered their skills in their time. So for example, there's a number of, so we're calling them working groups, but it's just smaller groups, a subset of people with particular skill sets. So there's comms, for example, a lot of guys through fan media and a lot of guys that work in their day jobs in a comms background. So some of that stuff, they all sort of coalesce together. But we've got a corporate working group that myself is involved in, where we're looking at things like, you know, the AGM, the shareholding, governance, how you can kind of maybe pull some of the levers around some of that stuff to, yes, to influence change. And what we've seen out of that, coming out of that, we've got lawyers and accountants and various other people who, for the sort of broader Celtic diaspora, who've wanted to get involved with the collective and offer up their skills and their expertise. So that's been really quite reassuring. So you're getting, you know, it's not just, as some people think, you know, a bunch of Trotskyists and Socialist Workers Party types. That,
no, no, we've been a Trotskyite.
Donkey. Like, I'm not saying that either, but...
No, I'm joking, I'm joking, but...
It's, you know, we're sitting about in our donkey jackets drinking cups of coffee on a picket line. We are actually trying to effect change in a as professional and as influential a way as possible. So to do that, you need to broaden your skill set. So we've said from the start, the guys and girls that stuck their hands up at that first meeting and who were online that night and joined in as well, that'll not be the people who see it all the way through. There's going to have to be evolution that involves people with different skill sets and people stepping in and stepping out. So I'm there at the moment, but I'm 56-year-old man. I'm not a rebel.
You're a young buck, man. Like,
I know, but
you're giving me 2 years. I'm joking.
I'll be there while I can help, but I'd hope to think and like to think that other people, if this becomes a longer term exercise, as it's kind of starting to look at, like it might, that there'll be people who'll feel at different points of that journey that they can say, well, I've got skills that'll help, and they'll be welcomed. So there's no preciousness that I'm aware of among the steering group, that their roles are sacrosanct, if I can put it that way.
Yeah. I mean, for me, more clean skins, they're calling them that, but you know what I mean? The more clean skins, the better, in the sense of, because there's people on the trust, and by its very nature, the Green Brigade, divisive, you know, like, as you say, we're not a homogeneous kind of support, in the sense that I've done a lot of stuff about Celtic sport and solidarity with Palestine and all that. I get a real pushback, you know, like, maybe more than you'd expect. I mean, Harry Brady talks about the silent majority. I've always argued with him over that. You know, there is as many people don't like this kind of stuff as do like it. And that's my concern in terms of the amount of energy you've devoted to the Green Brigade. It seems to have been, especially the position with them being out of the ground, like, can you not think there might be reasons why they're out of the ground? It's like, that seems to have been kind of dismissed in the sense of what happened that night. I mean, there's court cases pending and all that, so you need to be careful, but it's like, I'm no more predisposed towards the Celtic Trust or the Green Brigade than I am towards the Celtic Board. And I don't think I'm alone in that. I'd like a new Celtic that didn't necessarily have any of the three of them.
Right. Well, I mean, how to answer this? The best way I can put it is, if you want to call it the recent focus around the Green Brigade, now a lot of that has been because of the recent incidents, and by recent I mean November. It was the incident, which I assume you're talking about, the incident at the Falkirk game, when there was the club had obviously released video and released a couple of statements, and some of which, you know, in terms of the language that was used, was, you know, you could argue was quite inflammatory as well. So I kind of look at that stuff and, like, I'd look at any stuff, and you take it based on the facts. Now, as you say, court cases pending for a number of people, and that'll play its way out. But, you know, there's more to those stories, I think, than that'll come. You know, that.
Yeah, 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 yeah. I mean, I've heard more. I don't want to say on here, but I've heard.
So I'm the same. I wasn't even in the country, so I wasn't at the game. So I can't defend anybody, and I'm not going to. But what I would say is, there's more to those stories than is currently being publicised. But I guess then it comes down to a question of fairness and a question of appropriate and proportionality around punishment. Now, I look at things like strict liability, which Celtic go kicking and screaming against any time it gets raised as an issue. So my understanding of strict liability, clubs held liable for the actions of supporters or anybody who attaches himself to the club, and potentially the club could put itself in a place where it ends up with bans, etc., because of the actions.
Yeah, 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 no, I've been individuals. Pushed for it many years in the Scotsman, pushed for it many years.
Aye. So I look at that, and the club's, you know, diametrically opposed to that. And then you look at the treatment, the current issue with the Green Brigade, and you're looking at a ban for 250-odd people, something like 20 who weren't even at the game that night, and they're banned because of actions and allegations. You know, there are still allegations until they're proven. But, you know, you've got a situation where you've got, what, 2.5% of the Green Brigade are under investigation at a sort of police level, but the entire organisation's banned. And instinctively, it doesn't feel like it's fair in terms of how that's been managed. Now, we've all got history with Green Brigade. You know, I sit in 413, so I sit right above them, and Christ, they're noisy buggers sometimes. And
Noisy's good,
but the one thing I would say about being part of the collective, I maybe understand these guys a wee bit more than I did September and going back the way. Now, I've spoken to them about a couple of things and spoken to them about their view of things, because I've only ever heard the club's view and I've only ever, you know, developed my own opinion based on that. I think, coming back to your question, I'm not sure that it's a single issue thing that we're dealing with just now. The initial seven questions dealt with, the supporter experience and the way that for example, the Fairhurst inquiry and the instance around the Celtic Rangers game last year with the kettle and the Green Brigade outside the Supporter Association on London Road. That was one of the original seven questions. You know, I see where you're coming from, but I argue the other way. It says, well, this is just a broadening of what was an original concern. You know, it's a real example of an issue that divides. Now, divisiveness in the Celtic support's an interesting concept as well, because there's a lot of people look at some of the people who you or I might think is fairly mainstream and see them divisive as well. So there is a kind of vocabulary that comes with the Green Brigade and to a certain extent the boys as well, but a lot of us forget, you know, particularly our age, Andrew, and you know, some of us were daft young laddies, if you want to call it that, and young women that went to games in the 70s and the 80s, and I still, you know, people get very precious about Celtic Park. I went to the Jungle. I was in the Jungle for 15 years when I started going to games.
Likewise.
There's pretty much any incident that happens involving Celtic supporters, I could probably reference one at the Green Brigade in the Jungle that was twice as bad. You know, so there is a wee bit of
fireworks, mind you. I'll be honest.
I don't think fireworks were the same thing in those days, but you know, certainly seen a few.
You still have bangers near. There was a lot of bangers and all that when it ran about like a.
But the point being, I think there is, some of us need to take a step back. I include myself in that, because I've been quite dismissive in the past about the ultras and that bit. We need to bear in mind what our experience was going to the football when we were in our teens and in our 20s and in our early 30s. It's a different experience from what it is now. You know, going to football, I think a lot of the ultras are almost harking back to what the atmospheres at games were like.
Well, definitely. They're trying to. Yeah, that's what I sometimes feel. We'll get on it, the boycott and all that. People want their 90s moment, and we're in a completely different situation now. And like the Green Brigade want their 80s moment, when we had a new chant for every hunger striker that died the following weekend. But we're not there either.
It's a different club, but equally, people are people, and people coming.
No, but it's a different.
Their development, if you want to call that, is people. You'll go through a phase in your life where you're everything that makes you want to be an ultra, because they probably would have been ultras back then if it was such a thing. There was always tribes, but the casuals,
but do you remember the casuals when they used to try and walk round to the Rangers end, and it was like the Jungle would shout, casuals, get to fuck, and they would send them back because they didn't want factionalism.
I certainly wouldn't have put the Green Brigade in the same category as the casuals. That was a slightly different thing from my perspective. It was a wee bit more based in violence and a wee bit more based in
uniform. Uniform.
Uniforms, yeah. But anybody who goes to football with a scarf is wearing a uniform.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I just think it's people it doesn't matter what I think, really. Like, in this one, people know, I'll say plenty about it in certain podcasts. But in a sense, when you were talking there about, you've got your steering group and then you make decisions on. I mean, we did it. Me and my boy did it. Stood outside at Rugby Park for the first 12 minutes. You know, my family all do it. Not a penny more. But how do these decisions get arrived at? And how do you know that you've got a kind of consensus, as much as is possible to get a consensus on?
As much as possible. The steering group didn't make decisions in that respect. In my experience, it's been to make recommendations, and then things like the Not Another Penny, things like the three-game silence package, the boycott, the late walk-in at Kilmarnock, those all went to the original signatories, as it was at the time, and to what you would call the members of the collective. Time to organise meetings and talk about meetings, we've done that. If we've not had time, then it's gone out and we've asked for people to come back and, you know, yay or nay in an email form. And you know, so there's no really been, I think the only one where you could maybe say nobody told us about that would have been the protest at Dundee, the boys yeah. going in the park at Dundee. I think that was probably, there was some allusion at a meeting, but for obvious reasons, you know, let's call it tactically, they didn't want to say what they were going to do. So we got a bit of criticism for that one, but I think it's probably fair to say that anything else that you could pick out in terms of a decision, that was flagged across the wider membership. It's, you know, there's no 20 guys sitting in a room saying, right, I think my whole organisation will back this. You know, if you take how it's been working, if I take somebody like the CSA, for example, we've got a CSA rep in the steering group. If there's a significant action plan, they'll go back to the CSA executive committee. They'll discuss how they want to apply democratic means to supporting or not supporting that action, and they'll come back and tell us. And that influences the recommendation and the action. So, you know, it's based on democratic format, if that's the right word. There's not really been a situation other than Dundee, I think, where we've done something on the hoof and people have turned around and says, oh, nobody told us about that. You know, it has very much been going to the membership. Membership's the best word I can come up for it. The broader coalition, if you like, and saying to them, what do you think about this?
Yeah.
And I'll be honest, some of the stuff around the steering group has been to temper some of that. So for example, there was a spontaneous series of requests that we received round about the time of the defeat against Rangers and the end in Wilfred Nancy's reign, which was people wanting a boycott. It was loud, you know, in terms of the organisations and the buses in particular, saying, look, enough's enough. That all resulted in us organising a steering group meeting. We were actually getting ready to go to the meeting when Nancy got sacked, and we were sitting in the meeting while Martin O'Neill got appointed. So you're in a situation where you have to make a decision that says, look, has the mood just changed in the last 2 hours? Have we been, you know, you've got a democratic push for a boycott, but the steering group are sitting there going, well, actually, this situation's just changed since that vote happened. So you've then got to make a responsible decision and say, we'll go back to the members and say, well, I know you asked for this, but, you know, we need to give Martin O'Neill a break here, you know?
Yeah, you mentioned the CSA there. My understanding was, did they not pull out? In the sense of
Affiliation pulled it. Now, Affiliation was an interesting one, because Affiliation, and again, no knocking them, made their own decision based on their own, and it's what I said to you earlier, if anybody's not happy with how things are going with the collective, it's not a lifetime commitment. If people think we're doing the wrong things and we're doing things for the wrong reasons, then you're entitled to exercise your own right to be involved or not. But Affiliation was slightly different, because they never really fully embraced it in the way that other organisations have. Their rep on the steering group wasn't a member of their own executive committee, their own steering committee, so that actually made it communication quite difficult with Affiliation, right. If you know what I mean. So
they've
kind of always had one foot in, one foot out, and good luck to them, you know. They've made their decision based on the boycott, and I think there was a vote amongst their organisation, majority against, but there was still buses in favour, and we've subsequently had a number of Affiliation buses have joined us independently while maintaining their Affiliation membership as well, which the Affiliation told them they were entitled to do. So that's how it should work, you know. If people are happy or not happy, they should base their decisions based on that, you know.
Yeah, funny, because it was the other way around in the 90s, because the Affiliation were much more hardline about getting rid of the old board, and the Association were quite happy because they were getting the tickets, so they stuck by the old board right to the bitter end, man. Like, used to cause no end of grief and strife. So it's weird that it's flipped that way. But, you know, in the sense that then you get to, you don't have the Nancy boycott, but then it comes to the boycott, like, last week. And how does that, you know, how many people's opinions did you canvass for that? Or what kind of, I know there's no a voter, but how broad was your kind of backing for that?
It was everybody. So everybody in the in a broader community, if you like, were asked what their thoughts were and what their thoughts were on further actions. And we got a split. You know, when I say split, it was probably a reasonable majority, not a you know, 100% majority by any means. But there was a reasonable amount of people came back and said, well, we're for it or we're against it. And, you know, we had a meeting that week, and it was voted on for the people in the room and the people that were online. I think we had, you know, a couple of hundred people in the room representing their own organisations and representing themselves as individuals. And we had an online presence there, you know, good number of people as well. You know, it's one of the ones, that was the trickiest thing we've been involved in, Andrew, because, you know, emotionally, it's the antithesis of what you want to be doing as a Celtic supporter. It's saying, no, I'm not going to go to a game. You know, personally, I was, as I've said in my own podcast, I was very troubled with the decision making around that one. For the perspective of my own personal view, was I was probably more against it than for it. And then I sat in the room that night and listened to the strength of opinion for the people who spoke up both for and against. There was a number of people who spoke up against it, and, you know, very eloquently as well. And it was one of those ones where there was just no right answer. You know, from our perspective, you're trying to push for positive change. There's an argument to say, well, is boycotting games a positive change? You know, we've got to represent the views, not just of the people in the steering group, as I say. A very strong push from a lot of supporters' buses, which was quite interesting, given in large part those are the guys that and girls that commit their, I suppose they commit their lives to Celtic in a lot of ways, particularly, I think, people coming up from South England, South Ireland, North Ireland, huge time and financial commitment to follow Celtic. And if you're getting messages for those people coming through saying, look, this is the time, you have to do this now, then you've got to take it seriously. Whether you agree with it or not, you've got to take it seriously. And that's the position we found ourselves in last week, 2 weeks ago.
How do you reflect on that? Me and Harry were talking in our podcast on Monday that you maybe would have got 40,000 for that ordinarily, and I would think there was 24,000 in the stadium, so 16,000 people. But although Harry said that people buy tickets and then they don't go sometimes anyway, you know, it was a horrible night and all that. But say you got, I mean, you've got a pretty good response. I mean, I must admit, me or none of my family kind of followed any kind of boycott, but you maybe got about 15,000-16,000 people, we could say, that might well have actively chosen to boycott that.
Best comparison I had was what you were referring to there, was the same Saturday in February last year, same kickoff time, we played Raith Rovers in the Cup, and it was 39,500.
Yeah.
And I know we've not seen an official attendance, but, you know, I think, yeah, one of the guys in Celtic Underground said he'd heard it was 26, we heard it was just over 24, but, you know, visually you could tell it was in that sort of order. But look at that way and say, well, yeah, people probably did buy tickets and wouldn't have went anyway, because they always do for the Cup games. But that would have been the same last year as well, you know, for a Saturday in February. So I think realistically you're talking about, let's call it, a very large minority of the support.
Yeah, you would say, I suppose, what is that getting you? Is that about, so it's 30% or something, maybe 30% of those who would attend it, didn't attend? Roughly.
A lot of them will have been members of the collective, so they're going on, you know, the collective responsibility argument. There'll also be people who probably, you know, just kind of looked at it and thought, well, I want to show a wee bit of solidarity here. There might have been people who just didn't want to go to the game. So, you know, it's a difficult one to say that you can definitively say everybody who didn't go that night didn't go because of a boycott. But what I would say is, in the order of 16,000 people, 15,000 people didn't go to that game who ordinarily would have.
Yeah. As I say, I think that's, my maths is, you're probably better at maths than me, arithmetic maybe that is. But that's about 30% maybe that you could say that you supported it.
If you'd asked me before it, and a couple of people did, I would never have expected it to be, you know, like Kilmarnock in 1994, we under 10,000 there. You know, it was never going to be that type of night. What you were going to get was a significant number, and I guess a significant message being sent to the board that, you know, you can rely on the Celtic support, but you can't take the piss at them. You know, you've got to kind of to react to that. Again, we'll probably come on to it in terms of the communication since, but to me it's quite interesting that the timing of probably the two most disruptive incidents at Celtic Park since this whole thing started was the planned three-game silence, where I think we had the first game, then the board got in touch immediately afterwards to say, look, can we talk? And interestingly, we're now in a situation where we've had the boycott, and the Thursday after that, the club get in touch, or Thursday before the boycott, actually, club get in touch and say, can we talk? So it, you know, in terms of success of the boycott, what it has done, from my view, is it's made the club react and do something, which they've spent 4 months pretty much not doing anything in terms of engaging with any supporter organisation, including ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, I remember, sorry to bring back the 90s again, but when Fergus took over, and there was 36,000 turned up at Motherwell, and Celtic lost predictably, and then I think the Thursday night they played Raith Rovers, I think that was when Simon Donnelly scored the two goals and made his bit of a name for himself and all that, and there was only 16,000 there, and Ree Fergus is jumping up and down, and the part of the next day said, hey, where's the other 20,000? Where are the 20,000 gone? And it's like, no, you need to win games. It's like people will say they weren't going because the old board and all that, they weren't going because Celtic are key. Yeah. That's it, more than anything else. As I always say to people, Celtic were really badly run in 1967. They had a chairman who was picking the team. He was telling the manager to take players out of the, two years before, he was still the chairman. In 1987-88, when there were 72,000, look, you had a board of directors who hired guys with 10-gallon hats to do the frontage, right? They got absolutely ripped off. It was the same board, you know, like in 1994, but in 1988, they get 72,000. People will follow success. You know, that's what I wonder. Is it, how much is it about people? This is a difficult season. This is a difficult season, right? But you've won 13 out of 14 titles. And it's never really got to this point. Now, I know people have been bubbling under. There's been plenty of people saying the club should be modernised. People in this parish at Celtic Underground, we've all been saying it, in terms of the structures should be modified, in terms of one man using the club as a fiefdom and all that. But it's nail and jelly to a wall sometimes, isn't it? In the sense of how do you get from these misgivings or whatever, how do you affect change? And I know that's what you guys are trying to do now, but how do you?
I think a degree of extent, I think the catalyst this year has been probably calendar year 2025. If you actually look at where we were, you know, February last year, we playing Bayern Munich and coming off the back of a really fantastic Champions League campaign and feeling positive, and then you get to the January transfer window and it's another disaster and Kyogo leaves and we don't replace him. Then you get what sort of turned for a very promising season to sort of dribbled its way to the end to be a bit anticlimactic one, losing the cup, starting to decline in form, but starting to see the writing on the wall around the squad in terms of good players leaving and not being replaced. So if you actually look at the timing of the collective starting, we'd only just started the season. I mean, what really was the catalyst for, I guess, the open letter came off the back of the Qaira Almaty debacle and the Champions League qualification and the reaction to that in the transfer window, which kind of seemed like, that is what it is. Whereas the support, I guess, had a false dawn last season. Because it actually was maybe the first season, you maybe disagree with this, but it's first season I'd felt in European terms where we actually started to look like we might be taking it seriously and might actually have a chance of starting to build on the back of what Rodgers had said when he'd arrived for the second time around, wanting to build a legacy, wanting to make Celtic important in Europe again. Now, we're all realistic. We know what important in Europe and what successful in Europe means for a club in Scotland. It's no winning the Champions League. It might be getting to the latter stages of the Europa League and the Conference League, but you know, qualifying for the latter stages of the Champions League for a Scottish club at this point is a big thing.
It's tough, yeah. But
so to have gone through that last season and then get to the point where you feel that the club are maybe not taking it as seriously as the support are, and then you look at, you know, we've not talked about the AGM, but you know, talking about the Ross Desmond statement at the AGM, which is almost, you could paraphrase it as, look, sit down, little people, You know, we know what we are. We're not going to, you know, listen to use uptight whippersnappers telling us what to do. You know, we've no aspirations to be a European power at all. And you know, I can't remember the exact word in that, but you're coming. It's almost
landscape's
like
changed and all that. I think. I mean, I was there.
It has changed, but that's not the, you know, what, to a certain extent, if winning the league's brilliant, and this is the conversation, because I come from the east of Scotland, a lot of my mates are Hearts fans, Hibs fans, Aberdeen fans, and they look at me like I'm a complete dafty when I'm talking about this stuff, because, you know, what we call a less successful year to them would be a generational season for them, if they could win a league cup in a league, do you know what I mean? But you're trying to explain to them that it's about aspiration, and it's about wanting the best. No, it's not just about getting your money, returning your investment, because, you know, you've got a financial investment in the club, but you've got an emotional investment in the club as well. And we all just, I think the whole, in a nutshell, for everything that's happening off the field at Celtic this season is, it's a group of people who want Celtic to be the best it can, best version of itself that it can be, but not necessarily feeling that that's what the board feel like.
Yeah. I mean, I always say, I make a demarcation. I don't think the Celtic sport's entitled, because I think they want it to be as good as it can be, and they've seen misstep after misstep. But what I do think about the Celtic sport is, because I really don't think the threshold was reached for a boycott, but so I think they're kind of, and I've said it before on the podcast, I know it doesn't go down too well, but I think they're kind of emotionally incontinent. But I think that is now it's almost a universal thing with football supporters. I read a report, as I say, in the Guardian the other week about how football fans boo earlier than ever before. Teams never used to get booed at half-time. Now they regularly get booed at half-time. Somebody was measuring it, man, Real Madrid, the boos were starting, the grumbles and boos were starting about 20 minutes in, which they'd never seen before. So we live in this kind of, frenzy. There's a certain frenzy society where it's like instantaneous reaction. And I think, we've got kind of co-opted into that. So I don't think the Celtic sport is the Celtic sport of old, but that's just society. That's just society. And I know I'm maybe a man out of time, like as Elvis Costello said.
I don't even think it's that. I think it is a change in demographic, as you say, across a whole series of fronts. It's politically, socially, social media takes a big role
Huge.
In that as well, in terms of how people's expectations around immediacy and about, you know, getting the immediate results and getting
instant gratification in a way, isn't it?
And the other thing, I guess, is about, you know, social media and, you know, what comes from it gives people the opportunity to voice opinions, not always good, but opinions that they couldn't necessarily voice before. You know, you might have wanted, you know, in my day, you know, if you wanted to voice an opinion about a human rights issue, you'd find out where the march was in Glasgow or Edinburgh that month, and you would go to it. Now you can do stuff online, and you can post to your heart's content on Twitter. So I definitely agree. Football comes into that, and there is a degree of that in everything that if you want to call, you know, protest or activism, but certainly in football terms, I totally see that. And we need to be mindful of that in the collective. And we keep trying to remind ourselves of that, is it's not just about, you know, because you're pissed off this week. It's about what you're trying to set down or help the club set down as a platform for, you know, generations of growth. A lot of it is an argument between, you know, a group of well-minded people. I'm not for a minute going to say that the directors of Celtic are all, you know, evil or this or that. From my perspective, I've met 3 or 4 of them a reasonable amount of times, and they strike me as well-meaning and well-intentioned, just maybe no being allowed to exercise their roles to the fullest of the extent because of the way the club's structured, and
yes,
the club's structured because there's a lack of ambition driving it as far as we're concerned.
And it's because unless you change the man at the top, you know, you're just moving you can move the pawns in and out, but you know, like you really need to get to the kingmakers, don't you?
And that's the thing. I mean, you're trying to influence things, that is the whole basis of this. What we're doing is, none of us are, you know, we're not daft. We're under no illusions how difficult effecting transformational change in any business is, but never mind a bloody football club. You know, it's the hardest thing in the world to get that.
Among the United fans,
if you're not,
Blazers are still there.
Billionaire. Aye, it is, but what you can do is you can get to a position where in conjunction with the club, you communicate better, you get to a point where there's more understanding, there's more interaction, and what's the right word I'm looking for? Meaningful engagement with support, because that's the bit I think that misses the market Celtic completely. Is I think the club communicates dreadfully from top to bottom across the club, and I think part of that communication misfiring then results in a lot of misconception and a lot of misunderstanding between the support and the board and the support in the club. There's a perception a lot of us have that the club are really good at communicating when they're trying to sell you something. You know, if it's coming up to season ticket renewal, if it's coming up to new strips coming out, all of a sudden, everybody's visible, available and happy to talk to you. The minute things go bad, you get what we've just had, which is 4 months of utter silence. And that's the... I think most of us, Andrew, just want to get to a point where the club actually is taking some of that stuff on board, is open to ideas and is open to constructive criticism, because none of us want to be critical for the point of being critical. I can be quite critical about the Celtic board, and I could talk to you all day about that, but I could also tell you some good things that they do. You know, you've got to be understanding the fact that it's a horses for courses thing. It is about what is it you're trying to get, and we all want Celtic to be successful, but how do you get there and who takes you there? It's very, very difficult when you say you've got a minority shareholder, but that's where I come out from a corporate perspective. I look at the governance around Celtic, how we operate with non-executive directors, how the chairman works, how the chief executives, what their delegated authorities are to actually make decisions financially and otherwise. And that's not how a 100 million turnover PLC works. That's just not how it works.
I know. Although, as we saw so many countless times, like in the last 20 years, in terms of what you can get away with at business level, if we had any hair, it'd make your hair stand on end. It's like Celtic Army, and I know people were saying, push at them for the kind of financial regulation type idea, and, you know, these non-executive directors, they've been on too long, and good governance practices, they should be revolved every 3 years and da-da-da, or whatever, you know, but they're all small potatoes, aren't they? In the sense that nobody's going to, for the FSA or whatever, nobody's going to come after Celtic for the way they're, for their misgovernance.
I'm not an FSA expert, but I know what you're saying. From my perspective, you shouldn't be wanting to have to push down that route. You should actually be hoping that the club, both as a PLC and as a football club, are actually looking at it saying, right, actually, there's so many voices here that are telling us that they're not happy. What is it they're not happy with, and actually taking a step back and looking at it? And I'll give you a for instance. I mean, I was part of the group, and it wasn't the collective at that point. It was a wider group that went to see the club in October. Yeah, I was in the room for that meeting. It was a coach party. It was about 16 supporters there.
There was plenty actually from within the club there. I was reading, rereading
half it. Half a dozen within the club, but there was almost a perception of, you know, what's the problem? You know, when you're speaking to the guys in the club, they're kind of like, and I was expecting more. I was expecting a recognition. I'm not saying we're 100% automatically right, because nobody's automatically right in any situation. Generally speaking, you have to talk about it. You then have to find ways to work together and find solutions. You know, we go in and say, well, look, this, all seven. And it's almost a bit like, really? I'm kind of like, and that's where I get quite frustrated at that point, because I come from, I worked in a global bank with a very, very demanding chief executive who you might have heard of. And you would have lasted 2 minutes as an executive in that organisation in particular. And I'm not using that as an example of great PLCs, but I just mean generally.
Do you mean Fred the Shred?
It's Fred the Shred, but what I mean is, If any of you, and there'll be people watching this and listening to this who've got corporate backgrounds, there's very few PLCs, and I'm a independent consultant now. I work with a number of PLCs, a couple in particular, but it just wouldn't work if you were disengaged from your customer base and a chunk of your stakeholders. The argument that I guess the board make is, well, you know, you look at the votes at the AGMs and everybody's happy, and I think a lot of that is true, because when you actually look who's voting at the AGMs, you've got such big blocks of shares owned by, you know, corporate entities that are closely aligned with Dermot Desmond and the board, that it's really, you're right, it's tricky to kind of make inroads in that. So I guess, you know, it's one of these ones, Yeah, everybody's happy. The shareholders voted 95% in favour. That's probably true, but you know, how many of the shareholders are season ticket holders and travel to Kazakhstan to see the club play?
No, I know. I work at, like, it's one of the ones that other podcasts they hammer on a bit. Dermot Desmond shouldn't be controlling anything because he only owns 34%, but he can marshal, I worked it out, about 70-odd% of the shareholdings. We'll back him because their dividends keep rolling in. They don't care about what's happening on the pitch. They don't care about the infrastructure. They don't care about recruitment policy. They don't care about the academy. Their dividends are rolling in. This guy, he's somebody they can do business with. They can trust him to make sure that they're as they see it, you know, because they're so detached, they can trust him to make sure that their investment's protected and it's making the turnover.
And that's where I think, you know, where we have to try and...
That's where we're all frustrated.
Where we have to get to those guys is to try and help them understand the fragility of football. You know, we're in a global footballing situation where I think we're all expecting there's going to be further dynamic changes in how European football operates over the next few years. You're either on the inside of that or you're outside of that. We've been very lucky for a long period of time, the club will tell you, because we've had Peter Lowe representing Celtic at senior levels, and I believe might still be. So that is good for a Celtic perspective and a Scottish football perspective, but you can see where European football is going. It's stretching. Well, the top 5-6 leagues are stretching and pulling away for the rest, and it's getting harder and harder to get to the big table. At the same time, all of a sudden you're going for 13-14 years of, like, let's be honest, pretty unopposed dominance for by and large, apart from the odd cup. And suddenly you're in a situation where clubs are starting to think differently. Hearts, Hibs, a couple of other clubs are getting investment coming in, they're getting partnerships with other clubs outside Scotland, they're looking at a data-driven model in Hearts' perspective in particular. You've got Rangers that have sort of reinvented for about the 19th time their executive setup, but they are, you know, they've got strong backing now. So you can't rely on sitting on your laurels and... We'll keep the Rangers plus one principle, if you want to call it that, doesn't apply anymore. You know, we are at a European and domestic level, we've got to work harder. And you can't take your support for granted in that scenario. You've got to take your support with you. And that works for a shareholder and from a season ticket holder and away support and a casual supporter perspective. Those guys want quality product. There's an emotional attachment to the club, obviously, so you always have a hardcore of people who would go to see Celtic anyway, and it's quite a large hardcore, as a lot of us did when things are pretty shit, but equally...
Yes, I don't actually think it's that... Yeah. Bizarrely now, like, I don't know if it's that much bigger than even it was then. If it really came down to it, if Celtic were finishing fifth and whatever, as that happened during the 90s, I think you would be back down to the kind of 17, 20,000. I think that is still the hardcore.
We went back to the 30s, 40s during Dyla's time, didn't we? You know, when the stands got shut, the upper tier and all that. But the thing is, you look at it as a problem or you look at it as an opportunity. That's the way I used to look at things in business. And if you look at where Celtic are as an opportunity, there's a lot you can actually be growing into and there's a lot of things you could be planning towards. Now, it might well be the club are doing that. And this is where the communication side of it comes in, because they don't tell anybody. There's no sharing of the vision. There's no sharing of, here's where we see it.
Well, they rejected, they rejected setting out a plan.
And that's the thing. I mean, didn't get me, you know, we weren't talking about, you know, the old Chinese collectivism five-year plan stuff. I mean, what we're talking about is sell us a vision of the club. Give us a view. Tell us what you, as the leaders of the club, want to share with the support and with the shareholders. And that's not just about, you know, doing it on a 12-month retrospective basis, which is the way they do it just now. You know, you go to the AGM and you get the chairman's report and chief executive's report and, you know, Tony will stand up and do the foundation report. And that's all great in terms of this is what we've achieved this year. You know, it'd be nice to understand where we're heading. And I think at the moment it just feels like we're treading water around that stuff. I keep coming back to it, Andrew, the biggest problem at Celtic, you know, people say it's individuals and whatever. There's structural problems at Celtic, but a lot of the problems they create for themselves through communication or lack of. I think the communication strategy at Celtic is just abysmal. And I can say that with some professional expertise to put to that one. They just don't help themselves at all, you know? And yeah, I mean, you've been inside the club in the past, so you'll disagree or agree with that, but I'm talking about 2025, 2026 Celtic.
Okay, it's different. I mean, yeah. They're becoming battled. It's like they're in their bunker. There's a bunker mentality that's taking root. It's like they all hate us. And let's be honest about it, because it's been so personalised, people do hate them. They hate them. There's posters at the end of their streets, of their faces, with the kind of the no entry signs on them and all that, like near their homes and all that. So there's a retrenchment. They've gone into themselves. They've brought it upon themselves. I say that for a kickoff. They have brought all this upon themselves. But now they're in a position where, why would we say anything? Because they hate us. Anything we say, it'll be deconstructed, it'll be picked apart. And it's like, it was quite funny. It's like, hey, well, Desmond never talks, he never talks. And then he does that, like a blunderbuss on Rogers and said, how dare he talk? You know, it's like.
I look at it personally. I go back, 7, 8 years, whatever it was, when Harry Brady and I sat down, you know, after chancing it a bit with Lowell and saying, would you do a podcast and just talk about, and it was, you know, with retrospect, it was 45 minutes. It was quite kind of high level, if you like. We didn't get the chance to do the 10-part special that we wanted to do, but can you imagine Michael Nicholson sitting down and doing a similar thing now? You know, and that is the thing. I'm not even talking about what's happened since September. I'm talking about on the back of winning the league last year. You know, would Michael Nicholson sit and do it? He wouldn't. You know, the club do not have the charismatic individuals within the club who feel that they can step up and represent the club. Not a lot of the problems that come from, like the Brendan Rodgers thing, for example, you know, there's no point in us re-legislating how he left and what happened. You're right about Desmond's statement and that. But he'd had to be the voice of the club for a long time. It's happening to Martin O'Neill now. Martin's been stuck.
It's always... Jock Stein was the voice of the club, but you know what it's like, it's nothing new.
But I mean, where it was probably most, to me, most dramatically kind of put into perspective was when they stuck Wilfred Nancy out, you know, guys talking in his second language in a new country, trying to implement his ideas. I'm no shilling for him at this point, but every time he appeared in front of the press, he did it on his own. They never once sat down alongside. You know, when have you seen a managerial unveiling or first press conference at Celtic and there was nobody for an executive level sitting there? I was at Rodgers' first press conference when he got appointed in 2016, and on one side of him was the chairman, on the other side was the chief executive.
Yeah, it used to always happen. I know, I was there that night as well. Like, his shyness when he got his 15,000 people were like filling the stands and all that. Like, no, it was good. It was great, actually. It was great. There's no two ways about it. And I love what he gave to the club. So I'm no dissing Brendan Rodgers. He got a bit stuck. He got a bit stuck just the same way the board have got stuck.
But
become fixed mindsets.
A lot of the stuff that's happening now, I'm the same. I'm not always great about individuals being targeted and that, but I think a lot of it comes from frustration. It comes from the fact that the guys are, you know, they're pulling in, you know, reasonably big salaries, and not just salaries that are big for Celtic. They're big in the market. You know, if you look what Michael Nicholson gets paid as a chief executive compared to what a standard football chief executive at a club or size, then compare that to what a PLC chief executive in the real world gets. He's in a reasonably good place. So for that, I think you're entitled to expect a minimum level of diligence in how you deal with the support and how you deal with your customers. And, you know, it's fine, you know, once a year going on doing 10 minutes with Jerry McCulloch or whatever, that's great. But, you know, you shouldn't have to be dragged to that. And that's where you kind of feel with Celtic sometimes, is it's the only time you hear for the club is a reaction to something. There's never any proactivity, or there doesn't appear to be much proactivity. They don't get in front of issues. It's the bunker thing, but that then leads to frustration because people start, like me, turn around and go, well, he's not doing his job. So then it becomes personalised, and that, and then it becomes, as you say, it can go the other way and get a bit too personalised. But, and you know, none of us want that. In terms of, you know, I'll be quite unequivocal about that. You don't want any, you know, targeting people in a kind of violent or derogatory way. But I think it's entirely reasonable to be targeting people based on their competence and based on their perception of competence that they create.
Yes,
that, professionally for me.
Professionally, no, you're clearly well within your rights to question them in a professional context. As I say, it's like sticking up posters at the end of the road or whatever of them with a no entry sign. I don't think that's where we want to go as a Celtic support. But I mean, you know, you can talk about that. And what I would say is Peter Lowell was pretty available. You know, you met Peter Lowell plenty, but didn't he inure him from anything? I mean, he was as hated as anybody else. I mean, the Green Brigade hate Peter Lowell, and he's the guy that enabled them to have their section, first standing section in the UK.
Again, for a personal perspective, you're right. You've got the standing section, you've got the encouragement of the ultras, which I always kind of maintain is part of the problem that the club find itself in now with the ultras, is that they've maybe not been as good communicating with them as they should have been. You know, there's a lot of stuff falls on the Green Brigade, and the boys are, they're grown men and women, they're responsible for their actions, but the club can be quite good at encouraging when it's kind of okay to do so. But what I was going to say, come back to, was around the, you know, the innovative side. So again, example, the fan media stuff. I was part of the first half a dozen. It was myself, Harry Brady, and a couple of other people, four other people who were brought in by the club around about 2015, 2016, to start consulting, was one way of putting it. You know, what's the mood? What's going on the ground with the support? Because you guys pick up through social media, blah, blah, blah. But the other part of it was, that was when the first, and you'll have seen it because you were in the business at that point, that was the first time that fans, I think, in Scotland had been invited into press conferences, had been invited into events at the club, and weren't at any point told, you need to do this or you need to do that. You know, you were encouraged to be part of that, and the club were really good at that. That was a good example of, maybe it was under Lowell's stewardship at that point. It was a wee bit more expansive and outward looking than it is now. It's, you know, we've got fan media bans and stuff now, but
they've battened down the hatches, although I don't know how much they then had it on a rotation, didn't they? It was two fan media every, I mean, you got it, what was it, three or four times a season? But you ask a couple of questions.
It's just the principle, though. It's just the principle of actually being open enough to people to help with the communication. Part of that back then, it was explained to me by an individual within the club, that it was to help counter what was going on in some of the wider press thing, you know, and there's your bunker mentality again, the conspiracy theories about certain papers.
I've moved on to thinking the press are the media are enemies, it's now their own support of their enemies.
Aye. So there was a wee bit of that as well, but I just thought back then, and for the intervening period, I felt it quite innovative. Particularly, we see, I think other clubs started charging fan media for access and that kind of thing, and Celtic never went down that road. And
no.
There is, to me, there's the glimmer of some hope there that you can actually get back to having conversations about that kind of thing, because actually, to me, there was a wee bit of vision in play back then, and now it just all feels, everything feels harder than it should be. Somebody said that to me the other day that was looking at us outside, you know, no part of the steering group, but just said, is it not just exhausting dealing with them? It kind of does, it feels a wee bit like, I always describe it as like that when you go to the showground and it's that wee thing where the gophers pop up and you hit them.
Yeah.
It's a bit like that. You're dealing with one thing.
Whack-a-mole.
Pop up over there, you know. But it just, you know, it's not a great climate just now, Andrew. It should be better than it is.
No, definitely.
There's nobody that's involved in the collective that's doing it for a destructive perspective. You know, I know that's one of the perceptions some people have, is that, you know, people want to bring it down, it'd be a great season if Celtic didn't win the league. Not at all. There's not one person that I know in the collective who wouldn't be heartbroken if we didn't end this season, you know, resurging, particularly, apart from anything else, even just for Martin O'Neill, because he doesn't deserve to be anything other than successful, that guy, you know, for what he's done for the club.
No, definitely. But I suppose there's certain elements, you think, there's certain high-profile Celtic supporters that have been on the scene for nearly 30 years and such like, and there's obviously the ultras as well, and you think there's a certain addiction to the drama That's what I feel, rightly or wrongly. I feel there's an addiction to the drama and trying to set up Celtic. Oh, I get back to our roots. Celtic canned the whole charity within a couple of years they'd been founded. Then their directors were getting the largest dividends of any football directors in the UK by the late 19th century. I mean, that's how, if you want to go back to the roots, this board are pretty much, you know, and all these boards, the nepotism and the sense of Ross Desmond, like with Dermot Desmond. Yeah, that's what used to happen, Whites and Kellys and all that.
I know it does. So two things in there. I mean, I kind of take where you're coming from about, you know, individuals, but again, I think a lot of that's perceptions. I came into the steering group not really knowing anybody else that was eventually, you know, became part of the steering group. And so I've had to, as I've done many times in my past, had to build relationships and get to understand quite quickly what motivates people and how you can work with them. And there's nobody that I'm working with in that steering group that I would say is anything other than got Celtic's best interest in heart. There's a perception that, you know, I can probably guess the names that are on the tip of your tongue, but I can tell you, you know, some of those individuals that I think you're thinking of are probably people who've helped temper down some of the more extreme suggestions that have come in to do certain things at Celtic, for example. You know, I don't necessarily see it. Like, I don't believe it's a throwback organisation. I think this is a progressive, forward-looking coalition of groups, and we're trying to use the best of what we've got available to us, and some of that will be people who've been around Celtic, in and around Celtic for a long period of time, and some of it are new people. I've been in and around the club for the last 12, 13, 14 years, going back to that stuff with Peter Law and stuff, but I'm maybe not as high profile as some other people are, but I find them easier to work with than you might think.
Yeah, yeah. And where now then? Where now? Once you, like, that's the kind of what people would probably consider the nuclear buttons a boycott, isn't it? So where do you go after boycott? Is it season tickets, renewals next?
I'll be honest, none of us would want to get to that point. We've got, as people are probably broadly aware now, we've got a meeting with the club next week, which was originally planned for this week, but was deferred at their request. And that's fine. So we're meeting with them next week, middle of next week, and I've got my glass half full, my happy hat on, whatever you want to call it. I'm happy to go into that meeting and hope that we're going to come out and make some progress. You know, I'm not thinking...
What is progress, Paul? You know, because it's quite, I suppose it's quite kind of nebulous. You know, it started with 7 points, then the next one was 5 points, then I suppose the last kind of statement was 3 points.
See, to me...
Because, I mean, if say they said to you, right, we're getting ready Mackay, we're getting ready, fine, the Green Brigade are back, we're getting ready Mackay, we're getting ready Nicholson, we're putting in a new recruitment structure. We've got this new manager lined up, can I tell you, call off the dogs, is that it?
It really depends what they tell us. I mean, from my perspective, it'll not be the four guys that go into that meeting that decide that. You know, we've got a wider group of coalition organisations behind us. We'll go back and tell them what they tell us. There'll be a consensus arise for that, Andrew, same as any other. You know, that's how coalition politics work. I'm not wanting to get into politics, but that's how coalition politics work. You find a compromise or a series of compromises that satisfy the majority of the people that are in your coalition, and you then you decide if that's the way you want to go. I mean, success for me would be certainly improved fan engagement, certainly improved communications. Communications for me, as I've said about a million times, are horrible. And then I want to see some lasting change in the way the club runs itself. You know, so I said at the start, I come in here for a corporate and governance perspective, so I'm wanting to hear what the plans are around that. I want to hear what they're doing with, you know, I'm not suggesting they're going to sit and tell us or ask for approval for who the new chairman or the new, you know, if there's a new chief executive to be, but I want to understand what the thinking is that gets you to that point, as opposed to, oh, I used to work with him, or I was at school with him, which has been the Celtic way for far, far too long. So if you can actually get some evidence coming forward of a change in mindset and a change in approach and some real concentration on how that's going to affect the supporters and keep the supporters on side, then of course that's progress. But yeah, I don't know. I'm prejudging that because I need to sit down with them. We went in October hoping that we were going into a meeting where they would put a lot of our minds at rest. You know, I'll be honest here, if they'd come into that meeting in October and said, right, we've got your seven questions, we can answer five of them, but two of them, for confidentiality reasons or market sensitivity reasons, we're just not going to speak to you about. I think we could have had a constructive conversation that day, but the conversation that day was very much around, why do you need to know that? No cop talks about that. You know, it was a kind of like almost a dismissive tone in terms of, we know better than you. And I think that is where I get a little bit concerned about what the club understand the Celtic support to be, because there is quite a lot of perception, I think, at board level that it's a kind of, in the same way I don't think it's a homogenous, you know, everybody's the same. I think sometimes the board treat supporters like they're all the same and everybody's got the same knowledge levels and the same backgrounds, and actually what you've got within the Celtic support is a very wide spectrum of Scottish and international society, people with different backgrounds, different ethnicities, different gender, whatever you want to look at it. But there's a lot of people in there that have got sharp business minds, and a lot of people. And that's why the club keep a lot of those guys close, and quite rightly so, because they, you know, those are the ones you want to keep close. You actually, you know, if you look at, you know, 94 as much, if no better than I did, but, you know, that was one off the pitch, if you want to call it that, in terms of how that battle was won. That was won by some smart accounting and some smart share purchasing, along with an activist campaign that was running alongside it, you know. So you actually, you know,
depends where your vantage point is. I always think it wasn't the fans; it was on-field failure in finance that changed Celtic's governance.
Aye, but the finance, Celtic ran itself into a situation which is no. I don't think it's going to do that this time. And that is, I think a lot of people come back to, you know, why the collective 94 was an existential struggle. This is slightly different in articulation, because this is about, it's not, well, you could argue it's existential, but none of us are being that dramatic about it. This is about maximising your potential. Back in 94, it was about keeping the doors open, really, wasn't it?
And definitely.
But it still came from the perspective that you had to look at things from a serious business perspective and look at it from a, you know, a supporter activism perspective. So that's where I look at what we're doing. It's about how you influence change, but you know, there's more than one way to do that. There's more than one lever to pull.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, it's now like a Celtic board either unwilling or unable to adapt to the modernity of, you know, like the. The like Ross Devson acknowledged the football landscape had changed, but what he should have said was, we have to change with it. You know, and instead he said the opposite.
That's the missing piece of the jigsaw. Is what is the vision? What is the strategy? What is the
Where is the hot water and the toilets in the main stand?
Aye, but as I mean, if, you know, the stadium footprint's an issue all in itself. Yeah, we've all got stories about what you see when you go into the club on a match day, and, you know, depending where you sit on the ground. I walk past broken breeze blocks holding up rusted metalwork when I go up to the upper tier of the north stand. So, but it's really about, at this point, it's about the club. I think they have to come out, whether it's, and again, I'm not precious about it. I wouldn't care if they don't speak to the collective or they don't speak to the organisations. If they go direct to the wider support and say, look, this is what we're doing, this is what we're going to be. I understand that as well. But at the moment, they're just no speaking to anybody, but they have to sell their vision of the club. You know, they're resting on laurels and resting on past successes and resting on recent successes as well. But, you know, a lot of us can see who come at it. I come at it from a strategic perspective, I guess, and I'm looking at it thinking, well, yeah, I worked for an organisation that went through a long, prolonged period of success, then very, very suddenly and rapidly external events exposed some major weaknesses in the company. And that's what concerns me about Celtic, is that they've done really well in a position where they should have done well in, but I don't think they've done as well as they should have, if I can put it that way.
Now there's external events that... Yeah, it's like, you know, the Warren Buffett thing, you know, it's only when the tide goes out you can see who's wearing swimming trunks.
It's like the recruitment thing's an interesting one. Like, so they've allowed, everybody thinks that Hearts and Tony Bloom, it's like sorcery and magic, all this data analysis stuff. Right? I know for a fact, as we all do, that Celtic have been employing versions of, you know, data analysis for a long, long time now. Don't come out and talk about it because it's just what we do. But you've got this perception that's emerged now in Scottish football that Hearts are doing something, you know, wildly different, and because the club just keep everything secret. We've got a wee black book that we deal, and all our secrets are in there, and we can't share any of them with you. And it's just
the recipe for iron brew.
Aye, but it is. It's the old cliche of the politicians controlling the narrative. So Celtic are terrible at controlling the narrative in any way, shape or form. It's all reactive. It's all, and then when things get too much, they just pull the drawbridge up and don't speak to anybody. That's where we're coming from, is be more expansive, be more communicative. There'll be disagreements. Like, none of us will ever get to a point where, I don't think there's any football club in the world. You mentioned Real Madrid earlier, most successful football club it's ever been, apart from the old Rangers, obviously. But they've still got an active fan base who are never happy. So no. You're never going to get to a position where everybody's happy. But what you can get is a position where people understand why choices are being made and why decisions are being put in a particular way. And that Celtic just refused to do that, which infuriates me. And I mean, if Celtic did that, I probably wouldn't be sitting here talking to you today. That would be as simple as that, you know?
Fair enough. And ultimately as well, sometimes you get into a rut where you just make too many bad decisions coming tumbling down on top of one another. And that's what I think we're seeing, that period where they're just making the wrong calls. Whatever they used to do did work to an extent, however. You might think it should have worked even better. Like, they should have been 10 in a row or 15 in a row or whatever, and there should have been four last 16s or whatever.
That actually comes back to a real good point for me, which is, you're right, there has been a stream of, or a raft of bad decisions in the last 2 years, or what appear to be bad decisions. But that's where I think some of the target individuals also comes from, because there's no perception of accountability. You know, you see guys like Paul Tisdale getting appointed and everybody looking at it thinking, why are we appointing the ex-manager of Exeter City to be the head of recruitment at a club like Celtic? What's his credentials? I sat and asked the question in the meeting I had with him, and I got a pretty bland, oh, he did a presentation for us and it looked really good, so we gave him the job. It was more or less paraphrasing Chris Mackay's answer. And then it's led to catastrophe. But where's the accountability for that? That's, I come from a background, if you made appointments like Nancy and Tisdale at the same time you were making some of the other strategic mistakes you've made, there'd be some accountability for that somewhere along the line. Somebody would say, you know, you'd get a tap on the shoulder to say, look, you've had a go at this, but, you know, and I'm not, again, I'm not targeting individuals to be saying that, but I'm just saying that is the perception of Celtic, is that you can,
I know, but
repeatedly.
I'm not, this isn't me just trying to be a board accolade or whatever, but where does that ever happen in football? How many managers have the Glazers had at Manchester United? How many managers is, your mad Greek owner at Nottingham Forest had this season? They don't go. They don't say, it must be me. Nobody says it must be me. It's like they,
but look at
they
the same
always...
time. How many times are those clubs that you've quoted changed their directors of football? Because that's the whole thing. We've not got anybody between the chief executive and... We've not got a span breaker like those clubs. So you're right, the Glazers are not going to sack themselves. Marianakis at Forest still going to interfere. But you've got other clubs where they'll hold people accountable at a senior level because they've got the structures that allow them to do that. Yeah, again, no using Rangers as a stellar example anyway, but how did they deal with their horrendous transfer window and their managerial appointment in January? They sacked their director of football. They sacked their head of recruitment.
But that was the guy when he was...
Sacked the chief executive, in fact.
But they appointed all them only a few months earlier, so it's not themselves. They don't question their own decision-making. They just you get a body bag, you know, you need body bags.
But again, I think it's interesting, you know, probably the most exciting manager we've had in the last, Rodgers is Rodgers. I'm not including Rodgers Mark II, but Postecoglou came in, nobody knew him, unless you were a really big world football fan and you had a vague knowledge of him. Depending who you believe and who brought him in, it was either, you know, he came in through the City Group link through...
Lovell,
or he came in, Don Mackay tried to present it as his appointment, but you had that wee spell of about 3-4 months where things seemed really different. You know, you had a new manager coming in, we were going shopping in new markets for players, you had a new chief executive who seemed to be, you know, looking at things slightly differently. Then that all got stopped quite quickly. But we seem to have a recurring thing at Celtic where the chairman and chief executive are, you know, appointed through relationships, if I can put it that way. You've just gone through a phase where the chairman came back after formerly being the chief executive, after never really leaving because he still had the European role constantly.
Yeah, but he's not involved day to day, whatever people think.
I'm not suggesting that, but what I'm just saying is a general approach. What we tend to do at Celtic is you get the best person for the job who the people in the club either know or who works at the club. You don't necessarily always go to the market. And that's what... that relationships are fine in some cases, but actually sometimes to get the new ideas and to get the vision coming into club for people who are not football people, to be fair. You know, Nicholson and Mackay and Brian Wilson and all these guys, they're all... I'm not going to say they've not got Celtic's best interests at heart. A lot of people think they maybe don't, but what I would say is they're not football people, so you need some strong individuals in there who understand football, who understand modern transfer dealings, understand what's required to actually put a world-class development structure in place to bring young players through. Because let's face it, our development structure, we're feeding every other team in Scotland apart from Celtic. You know, you actually look across the leagues, you know, 30, 40 guys probably playing in the lower leagues in Scotland or elsewhere in the SPFL, and we've got Callum McGregor and James Forrest and Kieran Tierney. You know, we're not bringing anything through. You know, I know, yeah, Dean Murray. What I'm saying is that conveyor belt doesn't exist either. So when
no,
you've actually...
I mean, it's hard now Scottish talent.
But there's not a lot of it, is there?
It's
hard to produce talent, but again, how are we benchmarking? Who's actually available that understands how that works? You need good people in there to run the business, but you need good people in there to remember that the whole business exists because of football. So you need the balance, and that's where I think our board's unbalanced. We've no football players, no football people on the board, and by football people I mean people who are actually coming from the business side of football. We've got guys who've came from business who've went into the business side of football.
Yeah.
But other clubs are looking at, you know, directors of football who are ex-players or ex-coaches or ex-managers or have come through a structure like another club that allows them to go and understand business principle, but at the same time understand football principle. And that, I think we've got a gap there.
Definitely. I mean, but the gap's deliberate. As Harry will always tell you, the gap's deliberate because, like, he doesn't want that. So the director of football would almost be a firewall between Dermot Desmond and the football department. But Dermot Desmond doesn't want the firewall because if he wants to kind of, like, poke his nose in, he wants to be able to kind of poke his nose in.
But I get that, absolutely get that. And that
I'm not saying it. There's no right.
That's where we are. That is, so you're never going to get to a point where we're a progressive football club unless we actually address some of that stuff. You know, I don't know what happens when Dermot goes. I'm not wishing him ill, but at some point he's 78, 79 year old. You can't keep doing that forever. Does that mean that Ross Desmond by default becomes a new Dermot? And that's where you kind of look at the governance of this club and say, that's not right. That's just not right.
I don't think he necessarily would. Judging his kind of whole, his nervousness around the AGM, whatever people think of what he said, like he's nervous, I don't think he would want to be that kind of...
That kind of the Uber
owner or whatever, you know? But on that note, like, I suppose it's maybe a positive one. Like, better times ahead, guys.
Well, careful what you wish for, eh?
I don't mean that, oh God, that sounds terrible, but I just mean, you know, like, there's always got to be a legacy. There's always got to be a legacy. I suppose rich people can, like, what age is Rupert Murdoch now? 92 or something?
Ah, it's true. But the thing I would say is that, you know, I kind of look at the collective as a grouping of people with, I was going to say like-minded, because that's not right, because people come out from different perspectives, but broadly speaking, it's people who've got thoughts on what they want Celtic to become, and I totally acknowledge there's a lot of people who also have opinions of what Celtic should become, and they're very different. And that's one of the big things, and one of the positives for me about being a Celtic supporter is you should be able to have those disagreements. You should be able to
Do you think we've got that pluralism? I mean, do you think if I went into the collective, and I was going to go to a few meetings, it's like, but they've always come up when I go to Dungavel and all that, so that tends to be Monday nights, and the meetings tend to be Monday nights, you know, I visit in Dungavel, so I haven't been able to go to the meetings. I thought, well, would I really be welcome to those meetings? Said, look, I've no great time for the ultras, and I've no great time for the Celtic Trust. That's cards on the table. That's just what I am as a Celtic supporter. I'm politically minded, I'm politically motivated, as I say. Like, I've done plenty of politics on this podcast, hundreds of, more than it previously, I would say, Celtic Underground was, but like, would I find my home in the collective? I don't think I would. I think if you're being perfectly honest, I don't think I would. I wouldn't go into bat for the Green Brigade because we don't know the ins and outs. And it just seems to be the de facto position is they've been wronged. That's what I don't understand. You know, they've been wronged a bit why they're out of the stadium. That's the de facto position.
I guess that becomes, it's like saying that the club's de facto position is that they've all caused trouble. You know, it's one of the ones, it's a perspective thing, isn't it?
No, it's they're a collective. I was up there last year and it was like the wee guys would pull up the snoods, no face, no case. So if you're hiding your identity, how can they tell who's done it? that's why they do it.
I don't know, I think it's a wee bit simplistic, honestly. I mean, back to your first point, would you be welcome? Now, look at me. I went in to that first meeting, myself and, you know, Harry Will. Him and I walked into that meeting. He's probably better known than I am, so he's maybe got a slightly different perspective on things than me, but that was one of the reasons for me getting involved, Andrew, was because I felt that I probably, I mean, you go back to my Twitter account for the last 15 years and I wouldn't say I was particularly pro-GB or pro-trust if you wanted to talk about my opinions over the years either, but you've still got to, you've got to make a decision, and your decision is how can you contribute or do you want to contribute in anything in life? And, you know, you guys do what you do around the podcast now, which is great because you're contributing to what you do, and I do the same with my podcast, right? That's fine. But I felt at that particular point in time that what they were looking for was some skills that I could offer that they maybe wouldn't have had otherwise. You know, they wouldn't have joined that coalition. And I'll be honest, I had some reservations about, you know, working with organisations and people that I didn't probably understand that well either. But to answer your other question, could you come along to a meeting and make your point, you know, a view or against an organisation? Yeah, you could. And that, I can evidence that with every meeting I've been at. I've chaired one of the meetings and I've been at, I think we've had four or five. I think I missed one when I was on holiday, but the last meeting, as I said to you earlier, was very, very, it was towsy at times in terms of, you know, people's opinions getting stressed, but it was respectful. You know, people understand that it's a broad, you know, if you're going to have a coalition of supporters groups and supporters and views, then you're not always going to agree. And it's about how you react when somebody says something that you don't agree. I understand what you're saying, but my experience is people are getting the right to express their opinion within the collective. It's not a default, de facto, you have to go this way or go that way. I'm evidence of that because I don't agree with everything that the organisation proposes. And by I mean that, I'm not talking about the steering group, I'm talking about the wider organisation. You know, people in parts of the collective are proposing things that I just wouldn't go near. And so my role in that case is then to put the counter argument and say, well, actually, how does this look? You know, what do you think? And then you reach consensus. So, you know, I don't, you know, I'd like to think I'm evidence that it's not a hotbed of militancy. You know, that's just not my background. I'm no, you know, I go back to when I was
16. I don't mind the militancy, as I say, it's like the football. As I always say, you know, if the Green Brigade, if they only stuck to politics, they'd be fine for me. It's just that they happen to be.
But as I say, you say to yourself, when I was 18, 19, I was going to the football and I was getting involved in Amnesty International and I was getting involved in the anti-apartheid movement and stuff that was relevant to us.
Yeah.
So I always look at, you know, people criticise, for example, there's a bit of criticism for some people around the Palestinian situation with Celtic supporters. And again, you're a good example of this. You've got strong opinions on it. I've got strong opinions.
Yeah, I've had plenty of pushback, more than I expected. I've had more than expected pushback.
I kind of look at it through when I was 18 and going down to London for anti-apartheid movement marches and that, and people are getting pulled in with my boss at work and saying, you know, your militancy doesn't really fit with the organisation that you're working for, Paul. You know? I think sometimes you've got to, guys our age, I've got to take a step back for that sometimes and say, if you're being honest with yourself, when you were 18, 19, 20, up to 30, you're probably much more politically motivated in an activism sense than
I wasn't stealing other fans' banners and wearing them and whatever, or like I wasn't running about the city centre before games looking for a Barney.
But other guys were, Andrew. That's obviously we. Maybe you
and I fought against them even at 18 and 19. I got any plenty.
It's not my place to defend everything that any ultra.
There's no discipline. That's why I don't see any discipline within under a brigade.
I think you'd be surprised exactly how there's a lot more rationality and there's rashness, absolutely, but there's rashness in the wider support as well. I just feel sometimes the Green Brigade become the bogeymen for a lot of stuff, and collectively they're absolutely not.
The boys are even worse. Like, they're even more sectarian and more loutish, I would say. But I mean, I've been in amongst every one of my pals has been at away games, told to fuck off out your seats because the ultras are sitting there. Like, people that don't know each other, because I know plenty of people that still go to away games and all that kind of stuff, get tickets for away games, I should say. You know, these are the kind of things that feed back. It's not about representing a political opinion. It's not about having a stance. I'm all for that kind of stuff. I think it's difficult for the club. I must admit, it becomes difficult for the. But none of us get thrown out. We all had, I was working that night, but my son and whatever had Palestinian flags that huge night. No, the club didn't bite back about that. They didn't say anything.
I know. I say always, the club attitude towards ultras always interests me because, like, I always can say, if they were so anti-ultra, they would just not have them in two separate sections. They would stop that. So I think the club are a wee bit more sophisticated.
Well, they fell out, didn't they? They fell out.
Aye.
The boys are an offshoot of the Green Brigade because they wanted to sing Roman and the Gloaming, apparently, was one of the things.
But they both work well together. And what I'm saying is that the club at the past have been able to see past some of the negatives because they see the broader positives. Now, I can't defend every single action, every single ultra in any club, not mind Celtic, but what I would say is that, you know, I think there's a lot of positives there. It needs to be channeled, it needs to be maintained and managed, and I think the club in the past and the Green Brigade have worked well together, if you take the Green Brigade in particular, and at the moment that's dysfunctional, and because it's dysfunctional, it's drawn a lot of attention again, a lot of it comes back to that one incident at Falkirk, which I maintain you've probably heard more about, and you've heard more about, and we'll hear more about when it gets to court. But, you know, I think the way the club came out, for example, and, you know, referring to assaults, etc., that's language you've got to be real careful with, because apart from, you know, it's sub judice, but it's also quite, you know, unless you've got the evidence to back that up, that there's been wide-scale assaults, for example, it's tricky using that language. And the charges that have emerged don't back up the club's initial version of events, if I can put it that way. But what you are going to get to is we need to get to a position quite soon where there's some decisions made around how the club wants to regard ultras. And that applies to any football club, but
I mean, I'm not against Celtic ultras it's not a specific thing. I'm against the ultra culture. I used to hate seeing it in Italy and all that, like bashing down the doors of the training ground to demand the manager why didn't he pick such and such as left back, and get over yourselves, you know. It's this kind of self-regarding, self-promoting kind of,
I think,
you know, self-centred.
Back in the day, probably none of us would have known what an ultra was, but because you only saw Italian football on 2 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon, so you never really had the same press and social media coverage. So I guess it's more a globalised movement now, if you want to call it the ultras culture, because it's easier to understand what ultras do, communicate between each other and all that. But again, I'm not an expert on that. I'm only going on, you know, the dealings I have with the guys that I deal with. There's members of on the steering group, the boys and the Green Brigade, and I find them rational to deal with, understand they understand that, you know, actions have consequences. There's no a kind of naivety around that as well. So I'm no defaulting towards saying that, you know, the all ultras are a bad thing. I think it's just part of...
No, I just don't like the concept. I'm not saying they're bad.
We're all entitled to not like stuff, but
I just don't like the concept. It's nothing to do with the Celtic ultras.
I think what Celtic...
It brings a certain factionalism for me that I don't think is healthy.
Celtic have either, whatever you want to look at, Celtic have either introduced or have allowed that to be introduced to Celtic Park. And it's
got, I said to Lowell, don't do it. You're going to try and ride the tiger. Don't do it.
And what we're in now is a situation where you need to actually make it work. And that's where I want to get...
Or you decide that you got it wrong.
You could decide that, but I think at the moment Celtic are straddling both positions.
Yeah, yeah.
And a lot of that comes down to changes in personnel because, you know, Lowell's away and you know, it's a different security regime at Celtic now. And I think that's part of the... Let's call it part of the problem is that there's no the same relationships that were there before, because before Lowell, through strength of personality, could deal with the guys, and
yeah,
the GB to, you know, grudgingly could trust them. And I think there's a breakdown in trust between the club and, as I understand it, in the ultras now, because the guys that they're dealing with on the other side now have got a different position of things.
Yeah. Oh yeah, as you say, you're entitled to have different positions or whatever, you know.
By what I said, Andrew, it's communication. It's miscommunication all over the place, you know.
But on that front, we've communicated for longer than I expected. So, Paul, thank you so much. And I've been
no
as guilty as what I was starting off accusing you of being guilty. We end up talking about the ultras too much, you know what I mean? I've done it, you know, guilty as charged. But no, thanks so much for your time, Paul. Brilliant to speak to you. And good luck with it all.
Thanks,
good luck with it all.
Thank you.
I'll be sniping for the sidelines. No, I'm joking. God bless.
Cheers.
Bring me sunshine in your smile.
We hope you enjoyed that podcast. There will be more along soon. Please share the joy of Celtic Underground. Rate us wherever you can find us on your podcast provision, and also subscribe to thecelticunderground.substack.com. As you'll be aware, there are two types of subscription. There's free subscription, where you get a certain amount of content delivered directly to your email address. And then there's a paid-for subscription, where you get even more content delivered directly to your email address as and when it comes out. Anyway, enough of me. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. And this is me, Harry Brady, saying good night and God bless. Good night.
Bring me sunshine in your smile. Bring me laughter all the while. In this world where we live, there should be more happiness. So much joy you can give to each brand new bright tomorrow. Make me happy through the years. Never bring me any tears. Let your arms be as warm as the sun from up above. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love, sweet love. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring